This is Acid Horizon, a theory podcast which confronts global crisis and the specter of a world that could be free. This is episode 25. Is metal radical? An interview with metal philosopher David Burke. Thank you for joining us. Welcome to Acid Horizon, the theory podcast. Today on the show, we have a gentleman named David Burke. David is a PhD candidate and contributor to music journals such as The Quietus and Astral Noise. David is currently doing a PhD on metal music and philosophy. This episode intends in part to build on our discussion of the politics of black metal, which we had with Benjamin Noyes a few months ago. The questions which this episode centers upon are, is metal radical? Or broadly speaking, what makes a genre radical? Or perhaps even more broadly speaking, how does music transcend the boundaries which it has created? And how might something like a genre cause a political or normative rupture? Also on the show, we have Adam and Matt. Thank you for joining us, David. So could you just tell us a little bit more about yourself and why is metal radical?
Sure. Okay. So, well, as you said, I've just started a PhD in metal studies. I've been doing metal studies since I did my undergraduate. My undergrad and master's dissertations both looked at various aspects of doom metal. So this has been a long time coming for me. And the piece that I wrote a couple of months back, which is called Metal is Radical, is a kind of summary of some of the major thoughts and thrusts that I've had over the past couple of years. And please ignore that Freudian slip there. So metal is radical for me in several dimensions. Firstly, there's a kind of inherent alterity to metal that naturally predisposes it towards boundaries, towards edges, towards limits, and towards the kind of margins of society, the margins of existence, the margins of culture, the margins of taste. But there's also a kind of more fundamental radicalism that I see in metal, which is its inherent fascination with mortality, with death. And I find this to be incredibly radical in its own context, given the postmodern world in which metal arose in, is one defined by the cult of youth, is one defined by the cult of unlimited economic expansion. It's very much typified by an aspiration towards infinity. And in metal's radical recentering of finitude and of mortality, I see the potential for a project to emerge that can move us away from capitalism by emphasizing our own limitations and our own, our own fundamental lack, as it were. So that's the kind of core to my belief, is that metal is radical because it has the potential to reject and transcend norms left and right, but also has something to replace them with, and that is an existentialist concern that has, as I say, has the potential to cause a more contemplative mood to enter society, cause more reflection, ultimately cause, I think, more thought and more care in the Heideggerian senses.
I think this project is very much worth doing, especially given that our now current conjecture, we're sort of in a point at which one of the grand issues of our current conjecture is that there is a failure of the negative, there's a crisis of negation. How do we not simply just affirm all these different things we've been asked to affirm by Nietzsche and, you know, Derrida and Deleuze, etc., but to actually bring in the force of negative to change our current political situation. And in as far as metal is an aesthetic vehicle for that, I think it's a very good one. I mean, as you said, the confrontation with death is a confrontation with the real possibility of negation, whereas the cult of youth itself takes itself to be an infinite, as you said, tends towards a spurious infinity. It's always got to keep on and on and on and building itself. And this is something that's in our aesthetic experience of everyday life is really something that's tending towards our own destruction. Obviously, if you can elaborate a bit on sort of to what extent existentialism sort of informs your project in the sense of what the main influence is. You mentioned Heidegger. I think in the piece there's a mention of de Beauvoir and Sartre as well, and how this confrontation with death could escape what is one of the real dangers of any political aesthetics, which is recuperation. And it does, I think a lot of people who are fans of metal, or at least seeing it from the outside, would feel that its radicality has been quite well recuperated.
Yes, I think that's... it's partially true that metal has been recuperated. I think as the genre has developed, it's actually started to disentangle itself somewhat from the state apparatus that it was originally bound up in. The label systems have largely started to move away from metal in a sort of long durée. And with the rise of tools like Bandcamp and also affordable studio equipment, the material reality of metal musicians is substantially changing. We're getting to a point where the independent scene largely drives itself out of mostly free labor. The number of promoters, journalists, musicians that I know personally that do it all for love of the art. There is no material gain that they get from it whatsoever. It is entirely driven by just love of the culture. That to me suggests something that could almost border on anarcho-communist tendencies, which is where I lie politically. I see a great potential in metal for a sort of community-driven labor and work to unfold. On metal and existentialism, I think, so I say, my thesis aims ultimately to tie all of metal together under this banner of existentialism. And I'm looking at it from a number of different angles, because I had a realization a couple of weeks ago that although I find Heidegger's understanding of existentialism very useful when looking at metal, his emphasis on authenticity, his emphasis on the being toward death, and also his relationship with natural environments and his kind of criticism of modernity. Although this is very useful, like the infinite number of metal musicians who are creating different projects and different perspectives on this one culture, it only seems fair to incorporate as many different existentialists in order to get a fuller understanding of this culture also. So in Sartre and de Beauvoir, I see a kind of liberatory existentialism that borders on Marxism, the idea of taking existentialism and making it collective. And this fits perfectly with the philosophies of people that work in grindcore or thrash metal, the more politically incisive kind of genres of metal. For others, it's Nietzsche, the idea of the heroic struggle, the idea of creating oneself to be the, you know, a tower of power, very literally, the obsession with power, the obsession with hierarchy. We see that over and over again in black metal. Or then we could look at Camus, and his notion of the Sisyphean labor is something that perfectly maps on to doom metal, with its constant reminding of one's own mortality, a constant rumination on struggle. This fits Camus very well as well. So really, I think it's fairer to say that I'm interested in the milieu of existentialist philosophers and linking them all in to metal. Now, I find that metal at the moment, metal scholarship, which is somewhat separate from black metal theory, which almost is its own field of study. Metal studies as a field has focused on a wide variety of different kind of unifying themes. Different writers see different major ideas as being kind of integral to metal. Some talk about authenticity. Some talk about chaos. Some talk about transgression. Some talk about the perpetuation of hegemonic white masculinity. Some talk about violence and alterity and so on and so forth. Now, basically, in the course of my thesis, I hope to show that all of these themes can be neatly encapsulated by philosophical existentialism.
So I wanted to build off Adam's first question, actually. Because there's a passage, a part of the article you're writing on Metal is Radical, which I think is coming out soon on The Quietus, am I right?
It's coming out in the next print issue of Astral Noise.
Astral Noise, sorry, yeah. And there's a, I'll just quote what you write here. You say, the overall thrust seems to be against postmodernism in the economic sense. Metal resists the emergence of lifestyle marketing by adopting stances and symbols that are unpalatable and thus difficult for capital to recuperate. It speaks of power behind the flat surface of the image, and it offers a meta-narrative unless one passes from existentialism into nihilism. And so I think, to build off what Adam said in the first question about the recuperation there, which your response to that, do you think it's fair to say that the kind of things which you identified in various areas of sort of the underground and extreme metal scenes, you know, about the volunteer work, the kind of community involved there, and the fact that it's done not out of a kind of commercial gain in most cases, but out of a simple love of what they do. Would you say, firstly, that it's the experience, there's something to the experience of being part of that community which changes your perspective on things in a more general way? That's the way I'd put it. Is there a kind of transformative element to one's consciousness in terms of being part of a scene or a community like that, insofar as it enables us to think about community and art and so on in a less commercialized sense?
I definitely think so. I think there are several aspects that we have to draw in here, and one of them is the notion of a certain kind of filth or impurity, a certain sense of wrongness that is inimitable to metal. You see this, I mean, just in the love of distortion, literally in the fetishization of impurity in the sine wave, we see a real attempt to confront the sort of dark underside of life. I think there's very much something to be said about metal in that you bring it upon yourself. You choose to, in the way that I use it, to borrow Game of Thrones terminology, is take the black. You know, you choose to do this to yourself, become part of this culture. And in a way, you are making life more difficult for yourself. You are invoking the struggle, which I think for a lot of young middle-class people, such as myself, who grew up and found metal as a means of developing identity and authenticity, this identification with the other, with the impure, with that which is incorrect, which is not normal, not only kind of reinforces the notion that one is being different and thus more authentic, but it also does allow you to gain some degree of critical distance from the world, I think.
So just to follow up on that one then, so it sounds like what you're getting at here is that there's more of a kind of existential transformation at work there. Than it's not so much that like metal becomes like necessarily a platform for political change directly, so much as that it being involved in that, in it to such an extent, kind of triggers a kind of existential transformation in the people involved. But in that sense, the problem kind of raises itself of what that sort of transformation might look like, given the often questionable politics of particularly your black metal, but not only your black metal scene.
I mean,
speak to that a little bit.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, as I said, we're drawing on a milieu of existentialists here, as it were. And lots of the people in the black metal scene really identify with the basically the misread Nietzsche, the Übermenschen Nietzsche. And this is why I want to emphasize basically that metal is radical and is so fecund for a political movement, because this idea has not been suggested before. Metal has normally been seen effectively as apolitical, as wishing to turn away from the world, as wishing to distance itself, try and other itself as far as possible, or even go further in, as in black metal sense, and try and negate. So at the moment, yes, there's a great diversity in the ways that people approach metal as a kind of existentialist tool, and it comes out in lots of different results. I want to emphasize the idea that metal has the potential. It's not at this place yet, but I think it has the potential to transform into a more coherent social movement with a unifying agenda that should help to sweep away some of these more, how should I say it, noxious politics. It's a contingent that I have to kind of wrestle with, not only as a researcher, but also I am Jewish. I have to live with the fact that in my culture of choice, there's a strong contingent of National Socialists. That kind of spurs me on, as it were, to developing the idea of metal as potentially a social movement that can get beyond this. I think that metal has the ability to sublimate and work through even these issues. It's already come a great distance, for example, in dealing with its gender barrier, in dealing with its own color barrier. And I think that metal's persistence now that it's been around for 50 years, I think something has to be said about why it has survived for so long. And more importantly, kind of what this means, if this truly means that metal is starting to develop a really kind of unique and also robust culture. It seems only fitting, I think, especially as an existentialist culture, that we do develop a project for it.
The part of our talk here that really resonates with me is the notion of metal being this kind of confrontation with death. And I was hoping that we could talk about death in relation to revolution. And what I mean by death here is not only an existential death, but the death of certain institutions as well, because right. I'm thinking about, you know, I do some work on Deleuze and Guattari, and I think there's a part of Guattari's work where he talks about subject groups as a kind of revolutionary group. And there's a tendency amongst revolutionary groups to not want to die. And this is something that Nietzsche points out, like, hey, the state just doesn't want to give itself up, right? That's it has internalized the death instinct in such a way that it will not allow for its own dissolution. And so I think there's a kind of a line of thinking that can be developed there where we can see metal as perhaps this sort of orientation or a confrontation with death in a certain way that can allow for the kind of death or dying that the state refuses, right? I'm curious if you've worked on a similar line of thinking.
Well, I think that's why I'm so drawn to the idea of metal as community rather than the idea of developing a metal state apparatus, as it were. I was quite interested for a while in the idea of metal being an ideology in the Zizekian sense. And then I read Sublime Object of Ideology and I figured out, no, that's not the case. I think it's closer to say that metal kind of performs ideology in a way. It wants to act like a fully blown ideology in the way that it has total kind of creative control and total it has endless manifestations and endless discursive features to kind of identify itself, but I don't think it's an ideology proper. I think that metal is definitely drawn more towards the idea of the community as something, because it is made out of, precisely as you say, it is made out of death. You know, not only do we have a constant reference to death and a constant kind of confrontation with it, both personally and aesthetically, but there's also this has a very lasting impact on the way people understand musicians in the scene. When people die, for instance, when Lemmy died a few years ago, now that was very, very sad, but it wasn't the sort of outpouring of institutionalized grief that we would have seen for, you know, Bowie, who died within a month of Lemmy passing. And that's not just from the fact that Bowie was far more institutionalized than Motorhead were. I think that really does speak to how metal changes the perception of its fans and participants. It does, I think, tend them towards an ultimate acceptance of death. And I think that is absolutely important for revolutionary theory. We need to be able to accept the passing of institutions, being able to so concerned with holding on until, you know, we're literally holding the skeleton in our hands is ultimately toxic. And I think there are some parts of metal that are very, very willing to accept this, but we also must contend with the fact that there are some parts of metal that are resolutely focused on an unhistory. They are resolutely attached to the idea of a past that never existed. You can see this all the time in black metal in its sort of late German romantic construction of Im Wald. You know, it's absolutely using forest imagery as a way to conjure up a pre-modern harmonious society. And that spells its own issues. But as I say, again, this is why I've had to approach this as it's an existentialist milieu, because, as I say, describing the idea of a pastoral, harmonious relationship between man and nature reminds us once again of Heidegger.
And it doesn't seem to be just only that. Metal, like many other genres, has its own sense of genre purity, right? And so yes. I think maybe some of the reactionary tendencies of metal and other genres as well is to make reference to this more pure time in the state of the genre. I was hoping that maybe you could say more about that. Like, why is it, for example, that we see within metal music, and you've already touched on some of it with black metal, but why is there this tendency for, you know, metal fans, metal bands to gravitate towards reactionary ideology?
I think there's got to be... Ultimately, the issue there comes down to the paradox of alterity, as I see it. When one willingly decides to separate oneself off from the norm, to other oneself, in a way, you are becoming, in a Deleuze Guattarian sense, nomadic. You're attempting to shirk whatever is around you and develop a kernel, something that is hard and robust and can travel through any situation. And this, unfortunately, tends very much to elitism. Metal is very much concerned with othering itself and keeping the elements that it doesn't like from normative society out. And this is what gets taken to a very full extent in the sort of truer than thou, more cult than thou kind of mentality that is popular amongst some metal fans. They're very, very keen on gatekeeping because they don't want normative society to enter their little club. And on the one hand, this self-othering can be very liberatory because it allows you to get outside of the constraints of norms. But at the same time, you carry those norms with you when you other yourself, you know? Your subjectivity, you can try and become a full nomad, but you will still have to go to the shops, you will still have to have conversations with people, and you still carry all of this baggage, all of this normative baggage with you. And this means that reactionary politics can slip in quite easily, unfortunately.
But I think one of the reasons why metal, at least in its ability to become an ideology in like the Althusserian sense of an imagined version of one's relationship to the world, the reason why I think it has such a perseverance in terms of purism and the tendency towards reactionary politics is because the ideology of metal, insofar as there can be an ideology of it in this very purist elitist sense, always takes on the form of a conspiracy. There is an underlying hidden, not even hidden self. There is, you know, you have the false you, and then you have the version of you that you imagine when, you know, Die for Metal comes on by Manowar, you know, everyone just hands you a beer, you go join the crowd and you celebrate in the hidden underground of your own trueness. And this is why I think part of the dangers and the fruitfulness of your existentialist account here is because I think a grand unified theory of metalness, metality, or whatever, that, you know, does need to engage with authenticity and also its dangers, because to be authentic in metal is to embrace this negativity, this impurity, but there is a sense as well in which this impurity can also be proclaimed as the real purity, the true purity hiding in, you know, hiding in the shadows, the real undergirding darkness of it. And this is why I think death is so important, because death is par excellence, you know, the example of a real abstraction. It's an abstraction from all bodily experience, an abstraction from all ends, all means. It's just there brutally. And I think this is where you can explain sort of the dangers of reactionary metal, because I think Ben Noyes puts it brilliantly in his essay on Peste Noire, in it's called Be True to the Earth, remain true to the earth, yes, from Hideous Gnosis. Then that essay articulates how there's a dual existentialist, but also radical nihilist sensibility in black metal, but I think this works for all metal, honestly, in which the idea is to combat the very alienating real abstractions of contemporary norms, contemporary capitalism, with a further abstraction. For you, it's death, for noise, it's particularly for black metal and pest noir, it's the opposite abstraction of a nation, a homeland, but also a homeland that has this sort of conspiratorial strain underneath it of the underworld, the darkness, the reactionary national Satanism. That's a good one. I was wondering how, to the extent, you'd relate the confrontation with death with abstraction, and where there are sort of possible lines out of this where we can produce a counter abstraction to capitalism.
Right. So that's very interesting. Now, I think that the argument there is that, yes, I think metal, in its obsession with death, and also as black metal theorists would probably put it, with negation, I think this does absolutely speak to a relationship with abstraction. But you've also got to remember that metal is very much focused on the concrete too. It's an odd relationship, I would say. Because on the one hand, yes, when you have black metal fans or musicians or even theorists really honing in on this idea of negating abstractions that are out there in the world, providing an abstraction that's ready to challenge all of the others that have been laid before, it ultimately provides such a massive gap between the ego ideal and the actual lived experience of the subject. We've got to remember that the lived experience of the subject is a 20-year-old skinny Norwegian guy who spends most of his time being absolutely fucking miserable. Like, we have to be able to understand that there is an enormous gap between the ideals, the Übermenschen that black metal musicians want themselves to become, and their actual lived experiences. Now, as for how death kind of poses a counter abstraction to Capital, I think it has to really be stated how powerful an abstraction death is, because it's the thing that effectively frames the entirety of life. Whether we're thinking of it in the Heideggerian sense of the being toward death, or whether we're thinking of the Lacanian sense in terms of lack, death is the thing that ultimately frames the whole of existence. This is the fact that we will be always tending towards nothingness. I wouldn't even say it's a return, because that's awfully cyclical, but a progression towards ultimate futility and finitude. And I say this really does provide a powerful counter-argument to Capital, which is predicated on precisely the opposite. Capital is predicated on the notion that there can always be more, whereas finitude, mortality, is predicated precisely on the fact that, no, this is not the case. There will always ultimately be less. We might also want to play around with the dialectic here a little bit and suggest that in our obsession with death, metal has the ability to powerfully affirm the short few years that one does have on the rock. It's a powerful affirmation of life, of an authentic struggle. And I think that means that it has a real ability to challenge the kind of stultifying infinity that Capital lays out for us. It has a way of violently, rudely rupturing the kind of sleek tendency towards infinity, the smooth surface, as I said in my paper. It has a way of challenging this, not just through impurity, not just through negation, but by radically affirming the absolute impossibility of Capital, effectively.
I think that's really interesting. It makes me think of the way that people use the conceptual terminology of Deleuze and Guattari as a kind of capitalist jargon. They use the concepts of connective synthesis and the rhizome to talk about this incessance of connectivity. And the part that's overlooked is the fact that desire has within it this tendency towards its own dissolution. And that's to say that desire is always already coming to pass. And capitalism takes up this tendency as its own kind of death drive, and it forces desire to become dissoluble in a way that only serves the profit motive. And I think capitalism specifically prevents a realization of desire in which it becomes present to its own facticity, which is a kind of becoming unto death. So I think a big part of capitalist recuperation on many levels, individually and collectively, depends upon our failure to fully embody this aspect of desire.
Yes, no, exactly. I mean, that doesn't mean that metal is safe from recuperation at all. And in fact, that's some, we've already touched on it a little bit, but I think that recuperation is still a constant threat for metal. I remember a couple of years ago, I went to H&M, the clothing store, and I noticed that there were some hoodies in there that were using extreme metal type fonts, but they weren't connected to the band names at all. They were just using the Metallica font, a black letter font, and so on. And I realized, right, it really is very simple for capital to engage in this process of recuperation. And on the one hand, that might make me think that actually, yes, we should be tending towards black metal or the filthiest, most repulsive kinds of death metal and sludge, the stuff that is just impossible to recuperate because it has names like Liquid Shit or there was a band called Piss Grave that put out an album this year called Posthumous Mutilation, which the album artwork was too bad to actually display on Spotify for a while. So they just had to run with a black cover. On the one hand, it might make me think, oh, well, we should be tending towards further and further extremity, more and more negation, just piling on this this culture war and hoping that eventually we'll be able to spin our wheels and elude capital. But ultimately, I don't think that's possible. What I think instead is required is that we need to be affirmative, effectively. We need to use negativity in an affirmative sense to challenge a positivity, an affirmation that appears, as you say, to have no negative side. We need to bring negativity in to restore a dialectic, as it were.
Well, I wanted to say something there, because I know Adam will have a lot to say about affirmation in black metal. But before we get on to that, I just wanted to interject to ask something. I think we've adequately covered, you know, the sort of potential radical politics of extreme metal, or at least, you know, I personally would find it hard to see it as a sort of political project, but I'm fully on board with the kind of existential transformations which that can give to members of that community. But then my question then is it potentially a problem that particularly as you go into more, you know, extreme areas of metal, you know, black metal, death metal, and so on, is it a problem that these are so abrasive and difficult to understand, appreciate, get into, whatever, for most people, such that it still remains a very, you know, niche area? Because if this is a kind of trajectory which might, you know, at minimum inspire a kind of, anti-capitalist consciousness, how does one confront the kind of inherent difficulty of that medium for most audiences?
That is a very good question. I think that it must be emphasized that even bands that are right in the mainstream for metal still end up invoking all of these themes. And it's also worth noting that over the years, metal has... it's not just become a point where we've reached, total genre saturation, where there's every kind of subgenre combination now available. We've actually started to get beyond that. Metal is now getting to the point where it's interacting with the other musical worlds in a much more fulsome way than it used to. Metal is now interacting a lot more with pop, with hip hop, with electronic, with jazz, with folk, with classical. When we're starting really even to see the birth of metal as a fully recognized musical world. And this means that we can start to communicate the ideas of metal outside of its traditional sonic base, as it were. There's a, for instance, there's an artist called Poppy. I'm not sure if you know, or even Baby Metal.
Baby Metal, yeah.
Yeah, or even Baby Metal or Ghost could be brought in as all these examples of relatively recent bands who are playing it much more to the middle in terms of taste, but are still eliciting the right kinds of messages, are still invoking existentialist themes. So I don't see that metal, as I said before, I don't see that metal should be necessarily tending to further and further extremity. I think we're actually getting to the point where the musical world is present and it's fully functioning and it's ready for us to go out and interact with the other musical worlds, have metal fully stand up as its own culture that can be fully legitimated and recognized.
That's a really interesting answer, by the way, and thanks for giving that. I thought that's a really, really good answer. If I can just, you know, push you one last time, because I think it's worth, you know, all of us thinking about this as people who, you know, are interested in both these philosophical questions and this genre. If the idea is that, if not the sort of sonic element of metal, but at least the sort of some of the ideas which it represents might sort of filter out through this new interactivity with other forms of music, is there a risk of, in a sense, the medium undermining a message in these new genres, because presumably part of the work being done here is the music of metal itself. So is there a risk that as these kind of ideas filter out, but into more not just socially acceptable forms, but, you know, frankly, just I would say almost objectively easier to comprehend and understand forms, does that very medium, you know, particularly in a form of pop music, which, you know, we find in Adorno's analysis and so on, does that risk undermining a message?
I think there is a potential, yes. We've got to consider that the last three examples that I just cited are all signed to major labels. They're all present very much within Adorno's culture industry. And this means that it is, as post-structuralist sociologists would put it, a site of contestation. This is a dynamic that is happening now, and it is up really to the artists and to people like ourselves to make these arguments, get them out there, and have this and hopefully open up dialectics and dialogues over what can be done around this. I think there's certainly some bands are very, very good at communicating the ideas whilst toning down the music. And there are other cases where the music is being recuperated wholesale and just being used by other artists, and the ideas that are communicated through metal get lost entirely. For instance, like any number of hip hop songs that end up sampling metal riffs or guitar solos or whatever, are they engaging with the ideas? It would very much depend. But there, the sample is just one of an infinite number of samples to be used by the producer. It's just a surface. It's just a piece to be picked up and utilized. So, to answer simply, I don't know. It's a dynamic question. I think it's something that I think is still it's still changing. Do I think that ultimately impurity, the distortion, the raw power that comes through metal is kind of central to communicating its ideas? Yes, and I'm sure that Adam would concur through his reading of The Haptic Void from Hunter Hendrix's Transcendental Black Metal Manifesto. That kind of sense of intensity that is felt in the body and also to an extent in the conscience when you listen to metal, I think that is kind of integral to understanding its kind of existentialist message. But I equally think that can be portioned and, you know, dispersed as part of a single track. You know, you can have a very heavy section of a song, and then you can have a very different section of a song. This is something that black metal musicians, by and large, refuse to admit because they're very focused on achieving this pure level of intensity. Other composers, other musicians, I mean, for instance, Devin Townsend would be a great example of somebody who's able to bind lots of different genres together, lots of different moods, and still, when it's heavy, it is incredibly impactful.
I'd like to sort of take us on a bit more of the transcendental black metal landscape, but just first to build up on the point about the recuperation of the metal aesthetic and the H&M example, I think you can really see this recuperation of the metal aesthetic for things that aren't necessarily themselves metal quite easily. If you go to crit-grip.com and you check out the black metal Guattari and the Deicide Deleuze t-shirts. Oh, for 20% off, type in the promo code Hegel.
How meta do you want to get?
How many more layers can we pile on?
No, I feel like I need to cite that Fisher line about how doing academic work isn't praxis.
I think every academic, and there's like at least three here in this podcast, like everyone doing academic work needs to keep that in mind every time they even start typing anything.
Absolutely. It always has to be, it should be towards something. And so that's why I'm interested in developing. I don't want to study metal for pure circle jerkery, right? It's very easy to get, you know, very much into the theory, obsess over all of the kind of amazing ideas that one can lay down in words about how metal is this, you know, austere, powerful negation. I was looking through some of the notes for the Black Metal Symposia, and the way people like Reza Negarastani talk about black metal is nice but fanciful. I want to talk about metal in a way that gives it some real ballast and some real material ability to change, to turn into, as I said, I don't call it a political movement as much as I call it a social movement.
Yeah, I think this policy of affirmation when it comes to metal is something that I think is needed, not only as part of analysis of metal and its various strains, but also of an intervention into metal, because the affirmation, I think, is very well done, yeah, as you said, by someone like Hunter Hendrix, and her theory of metal in its history is being guided by one singular principle, which is the principle of reaching a pure sense of intensity, what she calls the haptic void. And this comes to a sort of standstill at the point at which we get to the black metal, because black metal culminates its intensity in the form of the blast beat, which is a constant pulsing of trying to reach as intensity, which eventually undermines itself, but it cannot never stop going, because black metal wants to get to the sense that it can never not start reaching for this pure ideal of intensity. And if anything, it fortifies itself around these notions of intensity and these norms of intensity. It becomes a new sort of orthodoxy, yes, an ideology of black, yes, metal, which allows it to resume reactionariness. And what she wants to do is she calls it re-annihilation. She wants to negate this negation, albeit not quite in the sort of Hegelian sense I'm probably portraying it in, because I know she's more into her Deleuze and French Nietzscheanism. There's also American Transcendentalism, but that's not quite my forte. But the idea is you don't simply keep trying to go towards the haptic void, this pure intensity, and stay there. You know, like as she says, you know, it's like a bird taking flight and not planning to land nor knowing where. Really, our point is to go through it. It's to go through this pure intensity. This if anything, it's a little death. It's orgasmic. It's a very orgasmic, clenching feeling, and then you're completely drained after the gig. It is an encounter with this complete annihilation of yourself, whilst at the same time being an empowerment of yourself. And eventually, you get to the other side. And if you get to the other side, you're fine. You're affirming life by going through this death on the other side, and a very dynamic relationship with it. And that's why the burst beat is actually a really good innovation, because it's accelerating and decelerating intensity, which is not committed to maintaining itself at all costs. It's not committed to its identity. It can engage with impurity. It can engage with contradiction. And that's why I do have to look at her again, really, of transcendental black metal, because the transcendental isn't something transcendental in a Kantian sense, where it's presupposed and then you sort of assume it to keep going, just keep yourself going for the sake of it, which is anything but more like what black metal does. It's priesthood sort of assume their own theology of eventually we'll become intense enough if we just act like complete
record badly enough.
Yeah, eventually it will turn into noise wall, which will become as much of a genre as I like it, lacks proper intensity. And I think this affirmative stance of affirming impurity, affirming contradiction, is part of the way to make self-conscious to metal and metal musicians and even metal fans an awareness of the sort of innate ontological plasticity that music and an experience of intensity engenders. And I'm not saying it's metal has a monopoly on this, but it's just one of the best it's the best site for it because it's so in tune with intensity and it's so inherently oriented around it. I mean, we can get a transcendental intensity from any music you like. I mean, Jungle is probably a good idea of people fortifying it, and then eventually, you know, you get the CCIU or some bullshit. But I do think this is where the potential is, the idea of giving up, not simply giving up authenticity, but understanding the concept of authenticity in such a way that you can be sort of authentically inauthentic insofar as you understand your own malleability, your own finitude, rather than going for this eternal ideal of making it with death, you know, becoming like a Thanos kind of figure.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's something that I think Hunt Hendrix misses, and it's due to her black metal myopia, effectively, and her assertion, which I take a lot of umbrage with, which is the idea that black metal is effectively a kind of perfected form of metal. I think that is pure nonsense, and effectively just carrying on the aristocratic elitism that typifies Hyperborean black metal, as she describes it, the Norwegian style. Because there are other moments of sheer powerful intensity in different metal genres that also acknowledge this finitude, whether you're dealing with the slam section of a death metal song where it goes down to the lowest possible tempo and every note feels like a spade hitting you in the face, or whether you're listening to sludge and it's lurching enormous walls of single notes. Often it's just playing one note and letting it ring out and decay, and that process of decay is so important because it's there that you understand your own finitude. It's how you get an understanding for the passing of time. Whereas I think Hunt Hendrix does get it quite right in that Hyperborean black metal is almost a freezing of death, very much. It tries to preserve the moment of dying and replay it forever. In a way, ultimately, that kind of black metal does, much to its own chagrin, act in quite a postmodern fashion.
I grew up in the era where we probably had the first intentional blend of metal music with another genre, which was Anthrax with Public Enemy. And I'm not sure if you guys remember that tune. Bring the Noise was the name of the song. And it was an interesting moment because it was at that moment in history and in music history where you had, I mean, there was a pretty firm split between metal and rap music at that time, right? And so what you had was there was this attempt at a crossover. And it's interesting that it wasn't just any rap group. It was Public Enemy, Chuck D of Public Enemy, who's a very revolutionary individual. It seemed to me that there was an attempt to sort of bridge the divide, not only aesthetically, but racially at that time. And the 90s were kind of typified by, well, on the one hand, you had this eclecticism in music. But on the other hand, you had the recuperative mechanism of capital, you know, taking all of this eclectic music and then totally commodifying it. But the question that I find interesting is, despite even being commodified, is there still a revolutionary road for metal music? So we're talking about, for example, the tendrils of metal entering into the world of pop and becoming bands like Baby Metal and appealing to people with more mainstream tastes. And of course, this isn't to forget the fact that metal has become more inclusive as time has gone by. There's more people of color, more women, trans folks who are now at the forefront of the metal world. And so for me, the question is, what is the next frontier of a genre like heavy metal or black metal to overcome? In part, it seems like all that's left is to expand class consciousness and maybe even connect with other genres in that way. And so what I'm ultimately asking is, what do you think it's going to take for metal to overcome capital? And I think it's important to address what Benjamin Noyes talked about in our episode on techno and black metal, which was the way that community can be hyper-insulating and exclusive in a way that doesn't allow...
Now, I think that metal's next big struggle is not is moving away, I guess, a little bit from the identitarian issues, though those absolutely remain and they are continued contestations. There is still a lot of often unspoken sexism that runs through the metal community. Mm-hmm. There's still a lot of more blatant racism that is found, as especially in, as we discussed, in black metal. How it approaches Capital, I think, is going to be predicated on whether metal can effectively step up to the mantle, and this is my hope for it, is effectively stepping up to the mantle of being a culture befitting of other revolutionary political movements. I'm not going to say that metal has a distinct political project laying out for it in one of its tendrils. I'm not sure of that actualization. But what I do see is the ability for metal to agglomerate onto genuine revolutionary praxis and act as the culture that can help to define those movements. It offers a cultural heuristic that allows new revolutionary movements to communicate ideologies of criticism, of affirmation of death, of mortality, of alterity, of difference, and also of violence, which I think is so key to the progression of radical political movements as we enter an increasingly surveilled and controlling society. The impetus in metal towards radical physicality, as well as just radical ideation, I think is critical here. So I don't think that metal, and so for now, metal still remains very much in this position where, on the one hand, it is trying to make genuine strides away from normative society, but on the other, it is constantly being recuperated because, quite simply put, if you play a guitar, you are paying a large company to do that. That is how it goes. If you want the technology to be in a metal band, if you want a microphone, if you want a drum kit, guess what? You are going to have to pay a large business for that. And until we can get to the point where metal communities exist in a physical sense, where we can actually own some trees and grow them and then cut them down and turn them into guitars for our musicians, until we can do that, metal is still going to be intrinsically mixed up in the nightmare that is the culture industry. And so, by bringing our attention to this, we at the very least have a chance of starting to work through this dynamic, figuring out what metal can be used for to challenge normativity in a much more material sense, and potentially avoid the problems that it's had over its 50-year history in becoming recuperated.
Mm. I think its economic framing is a very good way of putting it. And I wonder if the challenge, in a sense, is to take metal away from its sort of economic structure of consumption towards an economy of expenditure, you know, an economy that tries to go, because what is an account with death other than an account with the ultimate waste? At the moment, yes, it is consuming, it's always trying to reach the haptic void, it is always trying to maintain itself and its sense of identity as a pure elitist kind of metal in many different strains. And I think an embracing of this kind of expenditure, of this loss of, you know, not reaching the haptic void, losing it, encountering contradiction, I think this is something which it can provide an aesthetic challenge to Capital insofar as it awards itself towards a non-productivity, a waste, a collective expenditure of energy through the experience of intensity. And I think part of what this involves, I guess, is part of the project of a re-annihilation is a series of interventions in a very contradictory structure of a metal community. Because once, you know, at the same time, it seems very exclusive, yes, but it's also probably the easiest community possible for reactionaries to infiltrate, because it's not, sometimes, honestly, metal's not exclusive enough sometimes, because all you used to do is show up and go, oh, band, like band show, oh, I saw a band back in the day. Hi. What's your name? Oh, I'm UbersturmFuhrer666 on YouTube. Like, it is so easy for any Operation Werewolf cunt to show up at a black metal gig, and if he buys a pint and occasionally sings a tune from Wasp, he's in and he can do what he wants. I think there needs to be a much more radicalization of the consciousness of metal communities, and at the base level of safety, because, you know, insofar as we're only really as safe as our most vulnerable members. And yeah. I think this re-annihilation has to be, you know, an affirmation of the negation and the plastic power of metal, an encounter of contradictions in the way that expels any attempt at a purity other than a pure impurity.
Yes. I mean, I completely agree. And I'm speaking as somebody that doesn't come from the black metal world per se. To be honest, I find black metal, quite fittingly, I find black metal quite scary a lot of the time. It's actually so intense for me that it's difficult to listen to because it puts the absolute fear of God into me. It is terrible. And whereas I come from the much messier and also much more left-wing world of sludge metal, that's one of my main wheelhouses as a metal fan. And that community is first, as I say, much more left-wing, but is also, it is focused far more on the notion of impurity as just a natural state of being. It's not this kind of a high abstract ideal that we need to be aiming for. It's not this crystalline negation. We are looking at the muddy, messy, complicated, contradictory reality that is life. And that, and I find a great deal of affirmation in bands that just celebrate things like smoking weed, drinking, falling over, driving fast cars, doing stupid things, and laughing about it. Because that in its own ball of contradiction, in its own constant re-annihilation and renegation, that is what ultimately does produce affirmation. Yeah, I was saying on your point about the kind of difference between expenditure and consumption is that, again, I find that in the metal community's willingness to give up time, give up energy, give up their own money just to produce more of the culture really does speak to how it affects people's concrete realities and how it gets people to behave or act or think different in a concrete sense. And this is where the project of re-annihilation really needs to get going even more. I totally agree. But, again, it's not all about abstractions in metal, I think. We do have to remember that, it always boils down to the few people standing around a bar cheering for three guys on stage, you know, none of whom will ever see each other again. And they'll get paid absolutely nothing for it. And nobody had nice beer either. It wasn't a great night, but on the other hand, it was a great night.
Been there, done that.
Can I ask one final question before we wrap up? And it was, again, I'm sorry, every question I'm asking is a challenge because I really enjoyed talking about this with you. And I think, you know, me and Adam talk about this all the time as well. But is there a risk that we're overstating the extent to which any genre, you know, whether that, you know, even if that is, you know, a genre like metal where we, you know, even if we grant that it has there's a certain potential, you know, a latent potential perhaps within it to be much more radical in terms of the consciousnesses of the people involved in that. Is there a risk that we're overstating the political opportunities that might lie in that? Because I'm thinking here of the punk movements in Britain in particular, right? Over, well, you know, 60s, 70s, 80s, right? Where they were already much more explicitly political and much more radical in their politics in many ways than metal is right now. And even in that state, it was still... it still managed to become recuperated. And so I guess what I'm asking is, are we overstating or risking overstating the extent to which music or, you know, any genre of music can really have this kind of political impact, which we might like it to? Or are we perhaps better to sort of dial it back and sort of think about the potential that being part of that has for the way that people involved in that think about themselves and about the world, so that metal doesn't become necessarily a political movement or political platform, so much as it becomes a kind of gestation area for all these other kinds of communities which lie outside of it, whether it's anarchism or communist movements and so on.
Right. So I think we do have to be very careful in not overstating overstating metal's potential for political action. In punk, it is well worth remembering that punk was recuperated almost from the beginning. And metal too, in fact. Metal, as I said at the beginning, has actually taken its time in decoupling itself from capital slowly as technologies have become more available. If you look at the modern punk scene as well, which is something that is terribly underreported now, nobody cares about punk anymore. The modern hardcore scene is quite similar to metal. It is largely detached from the major label industry. Most of its fans do it for pure love of the genre, and it is edifying for them. Now, whether this can be translated into something that's genuinely radically political, I think that what I'm seeing in metal's kind of emphasis on existentialism is really very much a potential. It is not an assured thing at all, which is why I'm trying to step up to this project myself, because I do see some value here, but I think that we are a long way off from metal genuinely becoming music of the revolution. I think for the now, we have to be very careful that it doesn't slip into Zizek's enlightened Western Buddhism, where it just becomes effectively a cathartic means of self-help, which is one of its major social functions currently, but I think we need to be able to try and pull away from that. As for how we're going to do that, sadly, I think that's going to be my second book rather than my first.
Well, there's definitely a very latent acid communism to the potentialities of metal in terms of how primed it is to teach about intensity. I think there's definitely a huge potential for a kind of consciousness raising to it, especially given the very unifying group dynamics of a metal show. And to be honest, even when I'm on stage, I do power electronics, and I always play for metal crowds, and I always rip the fuck out of them, and they love it. They all know at the end there's something needs to be done, and they're quite receptive to it. And I think, especially from the outside, as someone who plays metal gigs but isn't in the metal band, I think it's something very ripe to it, but it has to be fought for.
Absolutely. But that, unfortunately, as I do want to keep emphasizing, that is the nature of the
also,
struggle.
Just a shout out for any listeners here, anyone who's interested in the intersection of hardcore punk and theory, check out Orchid, Chaos Is Me. Amazing band. They produce three of the best punk albums of all time. They're brilliant.
Yeah, Orchid are amazing.
So, David, you've been an awesome guest, and you've delivered far more than your paper promised, and that was actually a lot. So I'm really happy that you showed up on the show. This is a great conversation. Maybe you can kind of take us out by giving us a short list of bands that we should be listening to, and then maybe you can actually produce for us then a top 10 of new transcending metal bands, and then we'll put it in the liner notes for this show.
Wonderful. Well, my album of the year is Imperial Triumphant's Alphaville. This is an album that mixes black metal, death metal, doom, and jazz into a horrifying whole that is equal parts Fritz Lang's Metropolis and Blade Runner. It is a shocking, terrifying indictment of modern capitalism, and it is by far one of the most interesting albums that has been released in the past 20 years, and I'll die on that hill very happily. Other artists that have really caught my attention this year include Duma, who are a Kenyan duo who mix noise, hip-hop, grindcore, and industrial, and make this horrifying whirlwind. It's a true digital nomad music, as I wrote in a review a few months ago. And of course, I also really enjoyed Backwash, who is a trans Canadian who made an excellent doom metal / horrorcore album earlier this year. As I said, I'm very much interested in the sort of frontiers of metal where it starts to bleed into other genres. I will find a few bits and pieces and send you them for liner notes. Absolutely.
Well, now, David is quite the safe lad, as Matt and Adam would say. And I just want to say to you, thank you for listening. And thank you to all patrons and supporters who always make these episodes possible. Just having the moral support itself keeps us going really strong. David is someone that we met through our attempt at outreach to scholars who have interesting work. Our question is, do you know any more academics who have work that needs to be seen and that is relevant to the cause of total human emancipation? And maybe even not just human emancipation. What about emancipating animals and the machines? In other words, send us your stuff. We have a few more episodes in the works for the remainder of the year. Speaking of existentialism, I'm going to nudge the guys a little bit more into doing an episode on Fondane. In any event, we need to continue the discussion on existentialism. Moreover, we have some other ideas in the works here at Acid Horizon. We are dreaming up a sister podcast to Acid Horizon, which involves inner experience. And we'll let everybody know what's going on with that as things develop on our side. If this is your first time listening, go and find us on Patreon. We have some free episodes there that you can check out. Find us on Twitter, Instagram, and also we have a merch store that Adam conveniently name-dropped in the episode. But go ahead and stop by there if you want to check out some cool philosophy t-shirts and hoodies. That's critdrip.com, critdrip.com. In the meantime, everybody, continue being flaneurs in the borderlands of the new. And by that I mean stay on the Acid Horizon. We will see you next time. Also, the tune that you're currently listening to is called Just for Men by the band Enoch. Yeah, and that's me on vocals. Hope you like it.